Good morning, this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan with today's Wall Street Journal. The break is over. Companies are jacking up prices again. Higher tariffs, labor, and health insurance costs have pushed many businesses to raise prices. By Ruth Simon. Companies from Levi Strauss & Company to McCormick & Company, among others, say they are raising prices early this year on items from blue jeans and spices to housewares and industrial products. After holding the line on prices for several months, companies, big and small, have begun a new round of increases, in some cases by high single-digit percentage points. Companies had raised prices last year after tariffs hoisted costs. Yet starting in the fall, many firms held off on increases and sometimes offered discounts to capture holiday shoppers. The pricing break is over. Many companies typically raise prices at the start of the new year. Yet increases appeared to be stronger than normal for January for electronics, appliances, and other durable goods, said UBS economist Alan Detmeister. Some companies have pointed a finger at tariffs for their increases, while others, especially small businesses, also blame higher wages and hefty health insurance costs that firms said they can't absorb or share with suppliers. Prices on the most affordable imported goods are up by 2.3% since dipping at the end of November, according to data through February 10, collected by Alberto Cavallo, a Harvard Business School professor who tracks daily online prices at major U.S. retailers. The Adobe Digital Price Index found that online prices posted their largest monthly increase in a dozen years in January, driven by higher prices for electronics, computers, appliances, furniture, and bedding. Columbia Sportswear said it's upping prices of spring and fall merchandise by, on average, a high single-digit percentage, after mostly avoiding increases for fall and winter goods. The company said it has also renegotiated prices with its factories and taken other steps to reduce costs. When combined with our other mitigation tactics, our goal in 26 is to offset the dollar impact of high tariffs, Chief Executive Tim Boyle said in an earnings call earlier this month. Such new price increases follow last year's wave of tariff-driven price hikes. Retail prices started falling beginning in October, with the biggest drops before Black Friday, Harvard's Cavallo said. But then they started rising again, particularly after Christmas, in what looks like a post-holiday reset. Levi Strauss raised prices last month in response to tariffs and is rolling out additional price increases this month. Among the items now costing more, ribcage straight ankle women's jeans priced $10 more at $108, and original fit men's jeans that are $5 more at $84.50. The apparel company said it has more opportunity to raise prices on newer and higher-end products and is increasing prices by more modest amounts on lower prices entry-level items. Structural Systems Repair Group, a Cincinnati-based construction company, is taking a 10 to 15% increase in prices that will show up in new contracts this year. SSRG typically absorbs increases in material costs totaling 5% or less, but tariffs pushed steel prices up by 10% last year, said Brian Erickson, the company's president. SSRG's healthcare costs for its 115 employees increased by a similar amount, he said. It's not sustainable for us to tolerate that kind of increase. Without some sort of concession from our customers, said Erickson, whose company adapts and maintains parking garages, stadiums, and other structures. Higher costs can be particularly challenging for small businesses, which typically have thinner profit margins than big companies and fewer ways to offset higher expenses. By raising prices, companies risk turning off buyers, hurting sales. When tariffs prompted Stanley Black & Decker to raise prices last year by the high single digits on average, sales fell in the U.S., particularly for lower-priced items. The tool and hardware company is now looking at selective discounts, Chief Financial Officer Patrick Hallinan told analysts during an earnings call earlier this month. Sin, a company that makes housewares and lighting in Brooklyn, New York, is archiving items such as a ceramic planter that costs $450 because it doesn't believe customers will pay more and is upping prices across its entire lineup this year. "We try to absorb rising costs wherever we can," said Virginia Sin, the firm's owner. Yet the company, which usually raised prices on only a handful of items each January, took the across-the-board price increases because wages, material costs, shipping, and other expenses have all climbed. Starting wages for new employees and training rose 20% between 2022 and 2025. Many businesses have tried to offset tariffs and other inflationary pressures through cost-cutting and by pushing back on suppliers, but some companies said those options alone weren't enough. Tariff expenses added $70 million in gross costs last year and will add another $70 million this year, according to spice maker McCormick & Company. The company raised some prices in September in response to tariffs, inflation in core commodities, and higher packaging costs, and it is increasing some more prices this month. "Our pricing actions have been surgical," Chief Executive Brandon Foley told analysts last month. More than half of small business leaders said they plan to increase prices in the next 3 months, according to a December survey of 600 entrepreneurs by Vistage Worldwide. Nearly 70% planned increases of 4% to 10%, while another 10% forecast increases of more than 10%, according to the business coaching and peer advisory firm. Atomic Object, a Grand Rapids, Michigan-based digital software consultant, raised the hourly rate it charges its customers to $200 this year after boosting rates to $195 an hour from $180 an hour at the end of 2024. "We tested the market at $195 and said we would hold there," said Jeff Williams, a managing partner. "But increases in salaries and benefits are driving expenses higher and higher." The company's health insurance premiums jumped by 14% this year after climbing by 12% in 2025 and now equal nearly 10% of revenue, up from about 5% 3 years ago. World, Americas. Canada to prioritize domestic firms in defense spending plan amid U.S. tension. The government's strategy would lead to the creation of 125,000 jobs and a 50% increase in the country's military exports, by Paul Vieira. Canada is now seeking to create 125,000 jobs and increase corporate revenue by billions annually by ensuring domestic firms receive priority from a sizable increase in defense spending. A new defense industrial strategy from Prime Minister Mark Carney lays out a blueprint on how Ottawa intends to spend the tens of billions allotted to ensure Canada's defense spending accelerates to reach 5% of economic output, or the threshold agreed to by the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Furthermore, the strategy focuses on reducing its reliance on U.S. suppliers amid increased trade and geopolitical tensions with the Trump administration, with an eye toward closer defense ties with Europe, the UK, and the Indo-Pacific. Canada has a long history of working closely with the United States and looks forward to a continued strong Canada-U.S. defense relationship, the strategy said. To ensure greater resiliency in uncertain times, Canada is also undertaking efforts to diversify and build new defense industrial relationships. The Canadian government plans a formal reveal on Tuesday. The Made in Canada Defense Strategy was scheduled to be published last week, and journalists were sent a copy under embargo. The announcement was delayed as the Prime Minister, Mark Carney, focused on the fallout from a shooting in northern British Columbia that left at least 9 people dead. The Financial Times published a story on Sunday outlining the defense strategy's contents. Other media outlets followed with their own accounts. In the government's annual budget plan last year, Ottawa pledged to spend over 80 billion Canadian dollars, equivalent to about US $59 billion, on a cash basis to upgrade the Canadian military. Officials now estimate the total spending related to the military, from procurement to investments in defense-related infrastructure, will total about Canadian $500 billion in 2035. The Carney government is looking to capitalize on that new spending to create new jobs, as the country's manufacturing sector struggles under the weight of hefty tariffs imposed by the Trump administration on goods like steel, aluminum, motor vehicles, and forest products. Overall, Canada said the strategy would lead to the creation of 125,000 jobs, an increase in annual revenue among the country's small and medium-sized firms of Canada, $5.1 billion, and a 50% increase in the country's military exports. Canada's strategy intends to award defense contracts to domestic firms. In the event that it is not possible, it will pursue partnerships with multinational firms from trusted allies. Partnerships will be defined by joint work, joint building, and the sharing of key technologies and intellectual property in a manner that reinforces our alliances and underpins Canadian sovereignty, the government said. When it isn't feasible to produce domestically or partner with an ally, Canada said it would purchase new military equipment from abroad, although with conditions related to further investments in Canada's industrial base and guarantees that Canada maintain sovereign control over the assets. Prior to Carney coming to power, Canada had agreed to purchase 88 F-35 fighter jets from U.S.-based Lockheed Martin to help augment its aging fleet of aircraft. However, Carney ordered a review of that purchase, and Sweden's Saab has made an aggressive push for Canada to buy some of the company's Gripen jets. Carney's policy priority is to reorient the Canadian economy to rely less on the U.S., which has implemented a protectionist trade policy. About 20% of Canada's gross domestic product is tied to two-way trade with the U.S. Lifestyle, career. Workers are afraid AI will take their jobs. They're missing the bigger danger. It isn't whether artificial intelligence is going to replace them. It's who will control the knowledge that companies capture from their employees. By Matthew Call. Walk into any corporate office and you'll hear the same anxious conversation. Will AI eliminate white-collar jobs? The optimists insist that new jobs will emerge to replace the ones we lose. After all, it has happened in previous tech revolutions. Pragmatists argue the workforce will simply become more productive with artificial intelligence, creating more value with minimal job cuts. And the pessimists fear entry-level knowledge workers will become obsolete altogether. But this debate misses a crucial dynamic. Right now, workers are potentially training AI how to make them obsolete, and they often don't realize it. The kind of AI used by companies, called an enterprise AI system, can capture everything you do at work and use that information to train itself. These systems can record your interactions within the platform, the prompts you write, the documents you create, the queries you run. In other words, the company can potentially track and claim ownership of every keystroke you make within the system, every idea you document there, every tool you build using that platform. It can identify what approaches work best, what email language got responses, and how you approach those clients. And all that knowledge can become part of the company AI, so it may eventually know, down to increasingly fine details, how you do your job. Then comes the dangerous part for employees. The AI can pass that information along to anyone else who does your job, or in some cases, just do the job itself. Over time, you could become a lot less valuable to your employer, and a lot more replaceable. This dynamic may fundamentally change the relationship between employer and employee. The stakes are so high and so urgent that both sides are rushing to position or protect themselves. executives are rapidly implementing enterprise AI systems, seeking productivity gains and competitive advantage, and they often aren't disclosing the implications for job security and privacy. Meanwhile, at least some employees are secretly adopting personal AI tools, sometimes violating corporate policies, so that their employees can't capture everything they know and do. Capturing the essence. To understand what's coming, you need to understand what enterprise AI systems actually are. These are different from the interfaces you use at home. Enterprise AI systems are platforms that integrate directly into corporate workflows. Think of Microsoft Copilot embedded in Word, Excel, and Outlook, or Salesforce's Einstein AI woven into customer relationship management. These systems sit inside the tools where you already work, and they can potentially capture much of your work within the platform, learning from many interactions and embedding that knowledge into company-owned infrastructure. What once lived only in employees' heads, built through years of experience and hard-won expertise, is increasingly being institutionalized in real time. When you leave, at least some of your knowledge stays behind, embedded in systems that will be used by the AI and by your replacement, if a replacement is still needed at all. Imagine that you're a senior software engineer debugging a system crash. You run a bunch of tests to figure out the problem, and when you discover the solution isn't in the documentation, you develop a novel workaround. You share the solution with the company, obviously, but the expertise and techniques that brought you to the problem were all yours, in a fundamental way. You figured out the workaround because of what you know and how you work. That is the way things used to be, anyway. When you do your work through enterprise AI, though, the system doesn't just record your solution. It can capture your problem-solving approach. Which questions you asked first, how you refined the search when initial attempts failed, potentially even the logical steps that led you from symptom to cause. The next time junior engineers face a similar crash, the system may be able to guide them through elements of the methodology you used. You haven't lost your expertise, but now the employer has access to key aspects of that expertise in a form it controls and can deploy to other employees without you. It has a partial blueprint for how you think, and some of the knowledge that once made you indispensable is now a reproducible company asset. Making it personal. These revolutionary changes seem to put workers in a tight spot, but I believe employees have an alternative, one that isn't easy, but could help move the power dynamic back in their favor. Specifically, employees should consider avoiding their company AI systems when possible, and use personal AI tools like ChatGPT, Claude, Gemini, Copilot, or dozens of others. These tools operate on completely different terms than enterprise AI. You access them directly. You own your prompts, your workflows, your customizations. The knowledge you create stays with you. Most critically, when you walk out the door, your AI-enhanced capabilities walk with you. Maybe you're required to use your company's enterprise AI for client work, but all the strategic thinking you do before engaging with clients, develop that using personal AI tools. I spoke with a regional vice president at an energy company who does exactly that. He uses his firm's enterprise system for required compliance and documentation, but develops new analytical approaches and test complex decisions in personal AI tools. The novel insights stay his. What can be done? Using personal AI tools is just the first step employees should take, however. To really change the power dynamic, they can act on other fronts. Negotiate upfront. When joining a company, people should treat access to AI tools like intellectual property ownership. Most employment agreements cover IP created on the job, but employees should dig further into a company's policies before signing on. What gets captured through enterprise AI? How long is that data retained? Can you use personal AI tools for skill development? can you request deletion of your contributions if you leave? Most companies haven't thought through these questions yet, which means there is room to establish reasonable boundaries before you're locked in. Support collective action. Individual opt-out of AI is often impossible, so unions and professional associations need to pay attention. With collective bargaining, workers could demand transparency about the use of enterprise AI and demand fair compensation for the knowledge it gathers. Without collective power, individual employees will keep clicking accept on agreements that restructure their jobs simply because they have no alternative. Concerted employee action may start to change the AI calculus. Employers may find that enterprise AI systems do capture knowledge, but at a steep cost. They may drive away the most talented employees, ones who realize they can build more valuable, portable capabilities with personal tools. AI is breaking the traditional model of employment in real time faster than anyone realizes. The companies and employees who understand these dynamics will position themselves to capture AI's benefits. Those who don't may find themselves on the losing side of the biggest workplace shift in a generation. Sports, Olympics. The Olympics have been rocked by a cheating scandal in curling. The double touch and the hog line are at the center of a controversy that has Swedes tattling and the Canadians cursing, by Robert O'Connell. Cortina d'Ampezzo, Italy. The Olympics are where human beings accomplish the impossible. Skiers blaze down mountains at 90 miles per hour. Skaters spin four times in the air and land on a pair of knives. And Canadians, by reputation the nicest folks in North America, transform into something else altogether, the expletive spewing, potentially rule-breaking villains of the games. Canada's heel turn has come in curling, of all sports. This saga began on Friday during the men's match against Sweden, when the Swedes accused Canadian curlers of grazing the stone with their fingertips after they'd already released it. The move is known as the double touch and is highly illegal. Canada's Mark Kennedy took the allegation badly and snapped back with a crass retort that everyone in the arena could understand. F off, he said. The war of words intensified after an 8-6 Canada victory. Sweden alleged that Canada's double touches circumvented electronic monitoring equipment, which uses sensors on the handles of the stone, but not the stone itself. But this was one Canadian who wouldn't say sorry. He's still accusing us of cheating, and I didn't like it, Kennedy bristled, so I told him where to stick it. A curling stone, due to the immutable laws of physics, slows down as it crosses the ice. But over the weekend, the scandal rocking this quiet mountain town has only picked up speed. World Curling issued a clarification of the double-touch rule, emphasizing the critical importance of the hog line, the point after which no contact with the stone is allowed. Touching the granite at any time during the forward motion is not allowed, the statement read. Yet images circulated online that seemed to show that granite being grazed by Canadian fingertips, and on Saturday the Swiss men's team accused Canada of the same infraction. Kennedy, for his part, believed it was the result of a vast conspiracy against his team. The way he saw it, the Swedes were trying to win by technicality instead of skill on the ice. On social media, there was speculation that the Swedes planted a secret camera to capture the telltale angle. They have come up with a plan here at the Olympics to catch teams in the act, Kennedy said. It was planned right from the word go. World Curling announced it would position judges to monitor double-touching violations at future Olympic events, a level of scrutiny that came into play with the Canadian women's team on Saturday, when Rachel Homan was called for a double touch. 0% chance, Homan griped. There's no way. I'd love to see a video. But the double touch rule that has emerged as a flashpoint of international relations has, at this time, no official video replay. That means the only chance to relitigate this controversy would come in the medal rounds. If Sweden, with just one win in five matches, can actually make it there. Asia. A defector explains the remote work scam helping North Korea pay for nukes. Kim Jong-un's cyber operatives have faked their way into IT jobs at American firms and elsewhere, pocketing big revenue for a regime. By Dasil Yun. On a California-based company's internal directory, he was just another face in the grid of remote workers, a prolific software developer with a polished LinkedIn profile and an IP address tracing back to the Midwest. In reality, the man behind the coding lived in a state-run dormitory in China. His name was Anton Ko, and he wasn't Chinese. Ko belonged to a pipeline of elite Northern Korean operatives, identified, trained, and dispatched overseas by the Kim regime. Their mission? Generate hard currency for Pyongyang by stealing foreigners' identities to land remote IT jobs, with no gig more coveted than those from the U.S. "I'm a software engineer, and I have a great opportunity for you," Ko said, as he messaged dozens of Americans daily when remote work peaked during the pandemic. "It could be a lot of money for you, too." Ko, who defected to South Korea in recent years, provides a rare window into Kim Jong-un's digital warriors, who have managed to infiltrate hundreds of Fortune 500 companies, according to estimates from Google's Mandiant division. More than 40 countries have been targeted or involved in North Korea's cyber work, according to a U.S.-led consortium of 11 nations documenting Pyongyang's sanctions violations. The cyber agents are largely based in China and Russia, where the internet connection is stronger and won't trace back to North Korea. They generated up to $800 million for the Kim regime in 2024, the group said. American companies sit atop the list of targets because the high pay and intelligence gathering value. But the North Koreans don't just work alone. They seek to appear more credible to employers by paying Americans to host so-called laptop farms, where company-issued computers can be shipped and then used remotely by the North Koreans to appear online as if they were U.S.-based personnel. In November, the Justice Department said four Americans pleaded guilty to helping North Korean IT workers hold work at more than 136 American firms. These overseas IT workers are the cash cows among North Korea's illicit overseas labor, which helps funnel resources to Pyongyang's nuclear program. The Kim regime is known to seize up to 90% of a given worker's earnings, said Nam Bada, who interviewed defectors, including Ko and other former IT workers, for a report on Pyongyang's cyber operations. "A few IT workers can easily fund a missile," said Nam, head of Seoul-based North Korean human rights groups called People for Successful Korean Reunification, or Peace Corps. Due to their elevated roles in society, only a handful of North Korea's hackers or cyber operatives are known to have defected over the decades. Just a few have ever spoken to the media. Ko's account has been verified by South Korean officials and mirrors broader findings outlined in reports from the United Nations and third-party cybersecurity researchers. Ko said his overseas posting afforded him luxuries nearly impossible to find at home: steady electricity, nutritious meals, and internet access. "It was like watching color TV for the first time after a lifetime of black and white," Ko said of his first days in China. Paralyzing pressure. Ko was seen as a child prodigy by North Korean authorities. They placed him on a track for software development after he aced the exams to get into an elite middle school that fed to a top university. He went overseas shortly after graduating college. Upon arriving in China, Ko worked up to 16 hours a day. After 10 North Koreans crowded into a two-bedroom dormitory space, containing little more than bunk beds and computers. Portraits of the ruling Kim leaders hung on the wall. The revenue Kim and each of his colleagues generated was tracked in detail. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. At a monthly review session, the manager would hand out envelopes containing the workers' 10% cut. Coe felt humiliated if his envelope was thinner than the others. The pressure and embarrassment could be paralyzing, he said. Coe admits he lived a life unattainable to most North Koreans. On Sundays, a day off for IT workers who met their monthly revenue quota of at least $5,000, Coe and his co-workers went shopping for American brands like Nike and The North Face. They dined on famed North Korean cold noodles or grilled lamb skewers washed down with cold beers. Hitting the quotas got harder over the years, though, as North Korea's operations became more well-known. Some clients started demanding live camera interviews to land a job. Coe found a workaround by enlisting willing Western software developers to apply for jobs in their own names and even show up for video meetings. Without having to do any actual work, the Westerners typically received a lump sum payout of $500 or ongoing commissions of 30% or more. Coe handled all the coding or debugging work. Some were so enticed by Coe they forked over copies of their ID cards, which they got used by other North Korean IT workers to grab more work. The COVID-19 pandemic, coupled with better AI tools, turned into a breakthrough for workers like Coe. Remote working became common. Resumes could be written with native-level English proficiency. In recent years, video filtering software has allowed IT workers to mask their identity. The Kim regime recognized that remote job opportunities were plentiful abroad and raised the quota for IT workers to $8,000 during the pandemic, Coe said. The IT workers took on more jobs, translating messages into English and managing collaborators. Coe's account echoes those heard by Meng Chung-young, a South Korean cybersecurity expert who has engaged with former North Korean IT workers online and tracked their behavior for more than two decades. Most hail from elite institutions, speak foreign languages, and want U.S.-based work. They are online for weekends and at night, generating significant cash that helps maintain the regime, said Mun, director of cybersecurity firm Genian's Security Center. Internet freedom. The North Korean IT workers face constant surveillance, a lack of sleep, and pressure to perform, according to defector testimonies published in the 2025 Peace Corps report on North Korean cyber threats. During the work week, they are only allowed outdoors for short daily walks. Yet handing over 90% or more of their earnings to the regime was considered an act of patriotic duty, the report said. IT workers, including Coe, were generally sent back to Pyongyang every two or three years for roughly a month of re-education to reinstate loyalty after being exposed to foreign information. In that environment, we were being abused, Coe said, but we were also the perpetrators. Coe's manager installed monitoring software to track the IT workers' browsing histories. But to a group of software experts, workarounds were easily found. Coe said he surfed the web when the others slept. His loyalty to the Kim regime faded not long after his first Google searches. He searched for Kim Jong-il, who was North Korea's leader at the time and died in 2011. He read news articles about the dear leader drinking expensive whiskey during North Korea's massive famine in the late 1990s. At first I thought, this is a fabricated lie, Coe said. But he kept seeing news articles in which portrayals of North Korea differed greatly from those in Pyongyang's state-run media. He learned tens of thousands of North Koreans had escaped to the south. He later came to see all of the Kim regime's promises as deceptions. Following his escape, Coe's life in South Korea is also demanding. His IT job limits his free time, but he finds happiness in the quiet of his own home. Sometimes he finds himself staring at his computer screen, wondering how his old friends are doing and how they feel about him. Maybe they think of me as a dirty traitor, Coe said, but maybe there's a chance they understand me on a human level. Exclusive C-suite. Companies are replacing CEOs in record numbers, and they're getting younger. There hasn't been such a big crop of new leaders running corporate America in at least 15 years, and they have their hands full. By Theo Francis. Record CEO turnover at U.S. public companies has put the biggest class of incoming chief executives in years at the helm of massive enterprises, and the newcomers are younger and less experienced than before. About one CEO in nine was replaced last year across 1,500 of the biggest publicly traded companies, a new analysis finds. That is the highest rate since at least 2010, when the U.S. was emerging from the financial crisis. The pace doesn't appear to be slowing. Dozens more companies brought in new CEOs in January or early February, including Walmart, Procter & Gamble, and Lululemon Athletica. On a single day in early February, Disney, PayPal, and HP announced new CEOs, and last week Kroger named a former Walmart executive to head the grocer. The result is a grand experiment in leadership as companies grapple with the swift rise of artificial intelligence, the unraveling of long-established trade practices, and an unsettled economy and geopolitical order. We're in a new environment, and someone who's going to replay the playbooks of the past is not necessarily right, said Jamie Crittenden, head of the global CEO practice at executive recruiting firm Spencer Stuart, which produced the report. If the CEO doesn't get momentum both internally with operating performance and also with investors, then boards are more impatient even than they were. Many of the issues they face are a departure from conventional business challenges. Target CEO Michael Fiddleke took over at Target from 11-year veteran Brian Cornell this month, but he found himself posting a video message to employees days before addressing federal immigration actions in the company's hometown, Minneapolis. This isn't the first message I imagined I'd send, he said. In the last quarter of 2025 alone, companies with a combined market capitalization of $1.3 trillion appointed or lost chiefs, including Verizon Communications and Yum Brands, the parent of fast food chains KFC, Pizza Hut, and Taco Bell. Companies adding or losing new leaders in early 2026 have a combined value of $2.2 trillion, with Walmart making up nearly half, according to a Wall Street Journal analysis of data from corporate disclosure firm MyLogic IQ. Some changes were long in the works. Warren Buffett turned Berkshire Hathaway over to Greg Abel on January 1, a succession plan Buffett raised in 2021. Other changes were more sudden. CarMax ousted Bill Nash in November amid a slump in sales, ending his 9-year run. HP picked director Bruce Broussard as an interim CEO after Enrique Lores stepped down to take the top job at PayPal next month. Biotech firm Codexis abruptly replaced its CEO of 3 years with its chief technical officer, Allison Moore, and cut 24% of its workforce at the same time. Especially in retail, the cross-currents buffeting companies since the pandemic demand different approaches, said Adolfo Villagomez, who took the helm of 1-800-Flowers.com from its founder in May. It's a very different skill profile when you have growth as a tailwind versus when you have a lot of headwinds and you need to reinvent the company, said Villagomez, who previously ran a residential rental company and held executive positions at Home Depot. That's why you see a lot of change. There are signs this is more than the normal ebb and flow of executive reshuffling. Recent high-profile departures include long-tenured executives, including Walmart's Doug McMillon after more than a decade and Buffett after six decades. But incumbent CEOs are generally stepping down sooner than they traditionally have. Meanwhile, incoming chiefs are younger and less experienced than previous crops of new leaders, Spencer Stewart found. Incoming CEOs average 54 years old, compared with nearly 56 for last year's appointees. More than 80% of last year's 168 incoming CEOs were first-timers, with no prior experience running public companies or other major standalone enterprises. Two-thirds of them have never served on a corporate board before. Some, like Raymond James Paul Chokri, are younger than their predecessors were when they got the top job. The financial services firm promoted Chokri, 42, from CFO to CEO last February. He succeeded Paul Reilly, who was 55 when he became CEO in 2010. Executives who haven't run a standalone company aren't necessarily untested. Josh D'Amaro, the 55-year-old Disney executive slated to take over from Bob Iger next month, has been running the company's theme park and cruise unit with $36 billion in annual revenue and 185,000 employees worldwide. Younger makes sense to me given the changes in the world, said Cindy Jamison, a longtime turnaround executive who sits on boards including Darden Restaurants and International Flavors and Fragrances. Things are shifting and changing very dramatically and permanently, and you want people who've been in the trenches facing these decisions. When companies did bring in older and more experienced chiefs, it often reflected a scramble in tough circumstances. More companies chose a board member to run things day to day last year, usually a stopgap move that suggested succession hadn't gone as planned, Spencer Stewart said. That includes 15% of incoming technology, media, and telecom CEOs. New female CEOs grew scarcer last year. Just 9% of new appointments went to women, down from 15% a year earlier. Overall, about 9% of CEOs in the S&P 1500 are women, including 46 in the S&P 500, Spencer Stewart said. World, Europe. U.S. and Europe, no longer kindred souls, enter a marriage of convenience. Secretary of State Marco Rubio offered a warmer tone at this year's Munich Security Conference, but European officials say the transatlantic fissure remains, by Yaroslav Tremonov. Ask a European official who attended this weekend's Munich Security Conference about the state of the transatlantic relationships, and you're likely to hear metaphors about dealing with a troubled, possibly abusive spouse. Secretary of State Marco Rubio delivered a less pugnacious message when compared with last year's Munich conference. Back then, Vice President J.D. Vance launched a blistering attack on the government of Europe's largest nations and embraced their far-right political opponents. Rubio, by contrast, got a standing ovation after highlighting the importance of transatlantic ties and common history and culture. Yet, though the Europeans and the Trump administration are on speaking terms once again, there are few illusions. The deep fissure caused by last month's crisis over Greenland has been papered over but not fixed. What used to be an alliance of kindred souls is viewed by both sides today as a marriage of convenience, loveless and lacking basic trust. Now there is a new equation that you really don't know who is your friend and who is your ally. Kaja Kallas, the European Commission's head of foreign and security policy, said in an interview in Munich. Ministers, lawmakers, and military leaders who packed Munich's Bayerischhof Hotel over the weekend acknowledge that the common values that once bound Washington to its European allies aren't so common anymore. The focus of conversations has now shifted onto the bond that remains, hard security interests that are less susceptible to ideological risks. Elbridge Colby, the Pentagon's Undersecretary for Policy, told the attendees in Munich that he isn't sure that the one-time hosannas and shibboleths about shared values between Europe and the U.S. are true, at least when it comes to his part of the political spectrum. Yet, he added, the deduction is not being, hey, let's pull out, but rather, let's ground our partnership in something more enduring and durable and real, like shared interests. We have a shared interest in a Europe that can defend NATO territory, and so I would recommend focusing on pragmatic nuts and bolts kind of stuff. Highlighting the positive, many European officials noted that, ahead of Munich, Kolbe reaffirmed at the North Atlantic Treaty Organization ministerial meeting in Brussels the enduring American extended nuclear deterrence in Europe, even as he insisted that European forces will be primarily responsible for the continent's conventional defense. Kolbe also praised the strides that Germany and several other European allies have made in expanding their military capabilities over the past year. It was important after the discussions we had over the last couple of weeks to reaffirm that, on a fundamental level, we are allies, we are friends, we share the same history, our connections go deep in every direction, and it is acknowledged and appreciated that many countries in Europe are stepping up. Netherlands Defense Minister Ruben Brekelmans said in an interview. With Washington's focus on shared interests, the big question, of course, is the degree to which America's security interests actually overlap with those of Europe today. Seen from European capitals, the paramount security challenge is presented by Russia's war to subjugate Ukraine and Moscow's possible designs on the Baltic states and other parts of the European Union. President Trump, by contrast, has repeatedly spoken of Russia as a source of great business opportunities and of possible hedge against China, with senior aides like Steve Witkoff denying any Russian threat to countries outside Ukraine. Former Swedish Foreign Minister Tobias Billström said he found such attitudes disturbing. The U.S. has some permanent interests, and we have to take that into account. But the U.S. has to accept that Russia is a European problem, he said. What has worried me over the years since the new administration came into place is this constant downplay of Russia as a threat. The word Russia wasn't even mentioned in Rubio's Munich speech, which warned instead about the perils of mass migration, unfettered trade, and the climate cult. While Rubio said the fate of Europe will never be irrelevant to America's, he added that we are prepared, if necessary, to do this alone. Many European officials took these words as a warning that Washington's commitment to European security was conditional on aligning with the Trump administration's ideology. Rubio's speech was JD without a beard, said Jeff Rathke, president of the American-German Institute in Washington. Is a change of tonality without the change of policy. When European official described Rubio's Munich address as a slap, but while wearing a silk glove. The worst lesson we could draw from this weekend is to say, I can cling to some love words that I heard in part of his speech and push the snooze button, said France's Minister of European Affairs, Benjamin Haddad. Instead of fretting about Trump, he added, the Europeans must be stoic and focus on what we can control. Focus on rearmament, on the support for Ukraine, and the threat that Russia poses to all our democracies. Focus on competitiveness. Trump's pressure on Ukraine to accept a peace deal on Russia's terms and surrender unconquered territory in the Donetsk region, something that most European governments oppose, because they view such an outcome as emboldening future Russian aggression, has been a source of transatlantic tension for months. With Trump portraying Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky as an obstacle to peace, the issue could trigger another crisis in transatlantic relations in coming weeks, many European leaders fear. The lesson learned by these European governments from the previous crisis over Trump's demand to annex Greenland was that it pays to push back hard. Several European nations last month sent troops to the island, which belongs to Denmark, and threatened to use their financial muscle to retaliate against the tariffs that Washington imposed in retribution. Facing this coordinated response, Trump ended up withdrawing his tariffs and ruled out using force in Greenland. I definitely see that with all the strongmen, they respect strength and nothing else. So you have to either be strong or project strength. This is very clear. And if we are united, we are actually strong, said Callas, the European Commission's foreign affairs and security chief. A former prime minister of Estonia, Callas noted the inherent problem of separating values and interests. Our values are also our interests, she said. The underlying values of democracy and human rights, these are also the fundamentals for prosperity. While Europe and the U.S. don't always see eye to eye, she added, both are democracies in a world where human rights constantly come under fire. Indeed, despite all the transatlantic tension since Trump took office, much common ground remains, giving hope that the relationship could be mended one day. If the current American administration chooses to emphasize shared interests, this is okay, but we believe in our interactions with the Americans that there is more to that, Germany's State Secretary of Defense Nils Schmid said in an interview. If you look at the American political spectrum in a broader sense, you will still find a lot of people who insist on shared values, and I think we should not give up on that. Politics, policy, the battles inside Kristi Noem's DHS, five takeaways from the Journal's investigation. Criticism of the Homeland Security Secretary's tactics exploded during the Minnesota immigration enforcement surge, by Victoria Albert. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem has for months been the headline-grabbing, TV-ready face of President Trump's mass deportation campaign. She has aimed to burnish her personal stardom at every turn, staging aggressive crackdowns and sidelining officials who suggested a more cautious approach. Simmering criticism of her tactics exploded during the immigration enforcement surge in Minneapolis, jeopardizing her relationship with the president and her grip on the department. Here are the key findings from Wall Street Journal reporters Michelle Hackman, Josh Dawsey, and Tarini Party's investigation into the Homeland Security chief. A close relationship with Corey Lewandowski. Noem, who had little experience in immigration policy before becoming secretary, got the job in part because of a quiet lobbying effort by Corey Lewandowski, who helped the former South Dakota governor build her national profile. Noem's close relationship with her top advisor has raised concerns. Trump's first campaign manager in the 2016 election, Lewandowski, had initially wanted to serve formally as Noem's chief of staff. The president rejected the idea due to reports of a romantic relationship between the two, which he has continued to bring up, officials say. Lewandowski and Noem, who are both married, have publicly denied reports of an affair, but people said they do little to hide their relationship inside the department. A Homeland Security spokeswoman said the department doesn't waste time with salacious, baseless gossip. Boxing out rivals. Noem and Lewandowski have worked to curry favor with Trump and sideline rivals, including U.S. Customs and Border Protection Commissioner Rodney Scott and Border Czar Tom Homan. Officials at DHS said they believe Lewandowski and Noem see DHS as a stepping stone to even bigger perch. The pair have fired or demoted roughly 80% of the career U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement field leadership that was in place when they started. The DHS spokeswoman said all officials are on the same page and in agreement with the president's immigration crackdown. Damage control. After the fatal shooting of Alex Preddy in Minneapolis intensified criticism of Noem, she and Lewandowski moved quickly to solidify their relationship with Trump. The pair successfully requested an Oval Office meeting with the president 2 days after the shooting. Her team scheduled press conferences on other matters, including airport security and the border wall. Lewandowski also reached out to the Trump pollster Tony Fabrizio to cut an ad to help Noam, according to two people familiar with the episode. Fabrizio ignored the entreaty, the people said. The Homeland Security spokeswoman said Lewandowski's text to Fabrizio was about messaging. Some in Trump's inner circle have tried to persuade him to fire Noam, according to administration officials. But Trump has said he has no plans to dismiss her. The agency spokeswoman told the Journal that Noam serves at the pleasure of the president and called her efforts a roaring success. A $70 million jet. Noam and Lewandowski have recently been traveling in a luxury 737 MAX jet with a private cabin in back, according to people familiar with the matter. Homeland Security is leasing the plane, but is in the process of acquiring it for roughly $70 million. The purchase would be double the cost of each of seven other commercial planes the department is also buying at the pair's direction to carry out deportations. The Homeland Security spokeswoman said the plane was used for both deportations and cabinet-level travel. She said it was cheaper than military aircraft for deportations and saved American taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars. A missing blanket. Noam and Lewandowski frequently berate senior-level staff within DHS and give polygraph tests to employees they don't trust. In one instance, Lewandowski fired a U.S. Coast Guard pilot after Noam's blanket was left behind on a plane, according to people familiar with the incident. The pilot was told to take a commercial flight back, but was eventually reinstated because no one else was available to fly them home. The Homeland Security spokeswoman didn't address the episode, but said the secretary made personal decisions to deliver excellence. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Cicely Tiernan, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.